From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. No religious personality has captured so many Americans for so long as Jesus, but you might be surprised at how widely the American view of Jesus has ranged over time. Tonight on Point, America's distinctive and changing relationship with Jesus inside the Christian church and beyond. But first, although Saddam Hussein was captured without a fight, the rumpled dictator still had a streak of bravado. He reportedly told his captors that he was, quote, ready to negotiate. So is Saddam still holding a few cards or not playing with a full deck? Gerald Post is founder of the CIA's Center for the Analysis of Personality and Political Behavior. He joins me from Washington to consider the mind of the captured Saddam Hussein. Good evening and welcome, Gerald Post.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. What's your sense of what's on Saddam Hussein's mind as he sits in American custody tonight? Is this a thoroughly defeated man or not?
Well, certainly the man we saw immediately after the capture was a thoroughly defeated man. It was quite remarkable. He looked more like a scruffy street person, I must say. And the fact that he cooperated so obligingly with the doctor, looking for lice in his hair, examining his teeth. This man, who once made a fairly noted anchor person scrub her hands, almost a surgical scrub before touching her hand, quite amazing. However,
and yet after a shave and a haircut and a nap, Gerald Post, he was reportedly very feisty with the group of four Iraqi opposition leaders who came to visit him. They said he was vulgar, he was hot-tempered, and the American officials are quoted on CNN this afternoon as saying Saddam has turned from cooperative to, using their word, a wise ass in captivity.
And that seems much more to me like the Saddam I've known over the years. He has gained great credit in the radical Arab world for having the strength to stand up to the mighty West, and has gotten kudos for defying the West and providing a leadership model for his constituents. And I don't think he will squander that reputation. I think we saw his facade crack at that particular moment, but he's already pulling it back together.
Do you think that he's likely to be able to keep up that feistiness in U.S. custody? Is he going to be handled in such a way that if and when he eventually goes on public trial, he becomes another Milosevic, making his case again and again to the cameras of Al Jazeera and the world in a trial in Baghdad?
I think that is indeed quite possible. I've been struck. I did a profile of Milosevic at one point, too, and who is using the bully pulpit of the trial to play to his supporters back in Serbia. And I would imagine Saddam may well be doing that even now. Now, I do think it's important to emphasize the impact of this, though. You may have heard some of the comments in the Arab street were anger at the United States for humiliating him and anger at him for surrendering so abjectly. After 1991, there was a great deal of attention paid to what Saddam did with those who too early raised their hands to signify their enthusiasm for the imminent overthrow of Saddam.
Mm-hmm.
And Saddam tracked them down, jailed them and their families, tortured them extensively, and executed them. So he has had this kind of thraldom of terror over the land, and no one was really going to come fully forward until it was proven to a fairly well that he was either dead or captured.
But do you think his humiliation publicly via television, having his throat swabbed and looking so rumpled and all the rest, do you think that cracks the mystique? Is it over now for him?
Yeah, it cracks it, but it isn't entirely over, and there are still loyalists there, and this surely won't mean the end of the insurgency against him. But it is a major crack, and one hopes one can widen. I do think the trial will be important, and one of the main reasons it'll be important in that information-controlled environment that he created was to get at just the kind of evil he had perpetrated. It's now estimated between 300,000 and a million so-called opponents of the regime he had executed and buried in these mass graves.
So there's a big chance to lay all that out. Gerald Post, when you joined us on Point in March, you were of the opinion at that time that Saddam would rather die than be taken alive. In the event he was taken alive, given his psychological profile, were you surprised at how that turned out?
I was quite surprised. I felt confident he wouldn't commit suicide or leave the country, but I thought he would go down in a blaze of gunfire, as did his two sons, Uday and Qusay. And I must say, this indicates the kind of hollow man behind that grandiose, brave facade.
A hollow man, but still in charge of his facility, still wily, or so humble that he won't be much of an intellectual opponent for prosecutors and everybody who's going to be concerned?
I would not count him out. He's already being sarcastic and derisive in dealing with them, and I don't think this man will be easy at all.
Even in captivity. Gerald Post, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
My great pleasure.
Gerald Post is a psychiatrist and founder of the CIA's Center for the Analysis of Personality and Political Behavior. He's also director of George Washington University's Political Psychology Program. He joined us from Washington. In 1804, Thomas Jefferson took a straight-edged razor to his copies of the New Testament and cut out everything that suggested a divine nature for Jesus. And then he praised that Jesus to the heavens. Fast forward to the 1970s, Jesus cut a huge swath on Broadway in the smash hits Jesus Christ Superstar and Godspell. In 2003, Jesus is making more movie headlines with Mel Gibson's The Passion. Christian rock is hot. The Scriptures, Son of God, is front and center in the Bush White House. Americans, both Christian and not, have made and remade their understanding of Jesus over centuries, says religious scholar Stephen Prothero. In a new book, Prothero contends that Jesus is so much a part of the American culture and experience that, quote, one way you figure out your place in America is figuring out what you think about Jesus. Tonight on Point, tracing the evolution of the American Jesus. Who's your Jesus? A sage, philosopher, Lord and Savior, best buddy, role model? How many different interpretations of Jesus have you seen in your household, your neighborhood, your lifetime? And can any American have no opinion on Jesus? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Stephen Prothero, chairman of the Religion Department at Boston University and author of the new book, American Jesus, How the Son of God Became a National Icon. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Prothero.
Thanks so much for having me.
A fascinating book. I learned more in the first 50 pages maybe than I've ever known about this kind of evolution of people's sense, in particular Americans' sense and understanding of Jesus. I guess we all sort of think that whatever we learned in our lifetimes has been steady state from time immemorial, that's how people always saw this figure. We should just open up with a little history lesson for us at first about, I mean, you say that in the early days of America, even pre-revolutionary days, Jesus was by no means front and center in the most prominent forms of Christianity.
That's right. He wasn't really even a household name, even in Christian households. There was much more focus on God the Father, who was seen as this wrathful and distant divinity, and the community related to him as a group. And there was very little focus on Jesus. Jesus really functioned as a theological symbol who God used to save people and bring them to heaven, but Jesus didn't really have much of his own person or personality that people related with the way they do now.
But there was a changing attitude toward Jesus. You describe it as kind of turbocharged by political developments in some ways in the United States, by the emergence of the American democracy and the sense of exceptionalism and the Americans' right in the First Amendment for everyone to figure out their own relationship with God. But it's really Thomas Jefferson is kind of the edge of that blade, cutting away from the old Calvinist view where Jehovah was right there front and center and feeling the freedom to define his own relationship with Jesus. Can you describe, take us into Thomas Jefferson's perspective on the world and religion and how materially he made his own relationship with an own sense of Jesus clear?
Well, he was really part of two developments, obviously the development of the First Amendment and religious freedom. that really created this broad spiritual marketplace where people could go out and seek out different forms of religion and find a form of religion that fit for them and find a Jesus that fit them. The second was this revolt against England and against authority politically that translated over into a revolt against religious authority, particularly in the form of the king, the God King, who Americans really rejected around the same time they rejected the King of England and moved toward this Jesus figure.
So that's a fascinating thing you're saying. There was a kind of consciously or unconsciously a parallel drawn between George III and the great God King, and in that political environment, Jesus became a more acceptable, more attractive face of Christian faith.
That's right. He became one of us rather than having Christians focus on this divinity who was lording over them. That just didn't seem appropriate in a period right after the colonists had cast off George III. And Jefferson, in cutting up his Bible and finding his own Jesus, a Jesus without miracles, Jesus without the virgin birth, a Jesus who really was something like a talking head, a sage who delivers a sermon on the mountain and sounds essentially like a Jeffersonian Republican, he really was speaking for a lot of Americans at that time and a lot of Americans today.
Did Americans know that Thomas Jefferson was cutting the way open for them to make their own interpretation? How did this seep into popular imagination?
Right. Well, Jefferson was not an influential figure religiously at the time, except for as a person who was renounced as an atheist and an infidel. And that's one view of him that I really take up and argue that he was nothing of an infidel. He was really a tremendous lover of Jesus and had a real deep piety, but it was the sort of piety that ran against a lot of the popular thinking at the time. But people didn't know what he was up to because he was very private about his religion. He was keen on separating the public sphere from private spirituality. And so he didn't publish the things that he wrote about religion very much in his own life.
But somehow you describe his view as informing so much of the whole American conversation around Christianity and Jesus ever since then. How did it just bleed by osmosis into popular culture? What was the means of transmission? You say Jefferson's religious genius was his ability to imagine Jesus apart from historical Christianity, which in your view, which we'll go on to, opens the way for Jesus really to become kind of owned by everybody, Christian or not, because he's cut apart from that historical Christianity. How did that get out to the popular culture?
Well, it was already out in the popular culture to some extent, so I don't want to set up a view that this is Jefferson's idea and then it sort of moves out from Jefferson.
I think
it was part of the time, and Jefferson articulated it beautifully, this ability to look at Jesus and not simply say yes or no to this Jesus that was given by Calvinist Puritan theology. In his case, he would have said no, but to craft your own Jesus and then say yes or no to that. In his case, say yes to this Jesus as a great moral teacher and enlightened sage.
Craft your own Jesus, and that's really at the heart of what you're saying here. But I want to understand, you talk about Jesus as a national icon, and you're making a distinction there between the national icon and the traditional religious figure. And what's the distinction exactly that you're drawing?
Well, a national icon, all I mean by that really is someone who is celebrated as a figure who's important for the country, like Jefferson himself is, or like Abraham Lincoln is, or like Ronald Reagan is now.
But couldn't such a celebrated figure be completely rooted within a religion?
Well, it could be in some countries, but not in a country where the First Amendment is so important and where minority religions have such authority and where religious tolerance is so highly valued. I think that a figure who was utterly and clearly identified with one religion couldn't really function as a national figure. And Jesus has typically been understood, I think misunderstood, as someone who really stands for Christianity and Christianity alone. And that was one thing that surprised me as I went and did this research, was to see how much Jesus had been liberated by so many people from Christianity and had been and is seen as a great rabbi for Jews or a bodhisattva by Buddhists or an avatar of divinity by Hindus.
Well, there's a big, wide mural. We're talking tonight about the many faces of Jesus in American history and culture. My guest is Stephen Prothero, author of the new book, American Jesus, How the Son of God Became a National Icon. You can join us tonight. Who's your Jesus, Son of God, best buddy, great philosopher, Lord and Savior? How many different understandings of Jesus have you seen in your own household? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the many faces of Jesus in American history and culture, about America's distinctive relationship with Jesus inside the Christian church and beyond. My guest tonight is Stephen Protherow. He's chairman of the Religion Department at Boston University and author of the new book, American Jesus, How the Son of God Became a National Icon. You can join the conversation. Have you seen Jesus step out of the church and into popular culture? Is it the same Jesus either way or not? And are you a Jeffersonian who wants to liberate Jesus from the Bible, or a full doctrine Christian who wants him kept right there in the Holy Trinity? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stephen Protherow, you describe American Christianity as putting a greater spotlight on Jesus than was the case in Europe, than was the case in pre-revolutionary America. But I'm not sure I completely get it. Put this even in even a bigger historical context for us. If you look back at Renaissance artwork, for example, it is full of the figure of Jesus, very material, very present, very human in its depiction. What, was Jesus really less central during the Renaissance than he was in 19th century American Christianity or in the U.S. today?
Well, I think that the Renaissance is the period that really foreshadows the early 19th century, where my book really starts to move, where people really did take Jesus seriously as a human being, downplayed his divinity, though affirming it, didn't really stress it, really looked at his humanity, looked at his physical form even in Renaissance art.
But downplayed is his divinity. I mean, he's shown on the cross in this moment of ultimate communion in a way. He's shown in many religious settings. The halo is always there. He looks pretty divine in the Renaissance.
Well, he is still divine, and I think that you don't have to deny the Nicene Creed view that he's human and divine in order to stress his humanity. And that was going on in the Renaissance, but it wasn't Renaissance Europeans who came over to the United States and to New England. It was Puritans who came over, and those folks who really dominated American theology throughout the colonial period really had very little interest in Jesus whatsoever. They're interested in Christ as a theological sign, as someone who died on the cross for certain purposes, doing certain things for God the Father. But as far as relating to Jesus as a person, that just wasn't going on.
You describe then in the early 19th century and right on through that century, Jesus kind of breaking out into the American culture through camp meetings and the evangelical movement of that time. Characterize that movement for us. What was the kind of medium that carried Jesus out to the culture?
Well, you had these incredibly energetic preachers who went out, especially Baptists and Methodists, who went out in the early 19th century and created what we now know as the Second Great Awakening, where there was this tremendous upsurge in interest in Christianity in general and in what we now call evangelicalism or born-again Christianity. And their pitch, their message in this new spiritual marketplace really was increasingly Jesus. It was less and less come and be a Methodist or come and be a Baptist or come and affirm the Nicene Creed or come and do the Eucharist. It was, hey, here's this guy, Jesus. Why don't you accept him, take him into your heart, have him be part of your life? And it was that message of Jesus rather than Christianity or Calvinism or something else that really resonated among African Americans, among white people in the South and the North. And that's really what so radically Christianized America.
But it was all wrapped up in Christianity. I mean, it came with the Bible, the crucifixion and all that was there. They never really walked away from the notion of accepting Jesus as a savior in addition to a companion or walk with Jesus figure, did they?
No, they didn't in the early 19th century. They're still hanging on. They're getting away from Calvinism, but they're hanging on to the creeds. They're hanging on to the Bible. They're hanging on to Christianity. But the story over the course of the next 100 years is this gradual liberation of Jesus, not just from Calvin theology, but from creedal formations, from the Bible, especially by liberal Protestants in the late 19th century, and then finally from Christianity itself, particularly after 1965.
Before we jump to 1965, you also describe in the late 19th century what you call the feminizing of Jesus. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the mid-19th century, you get a tremendous influence of women inside the churches. Women had predominated in the churches earlier, but they start to really gain influence. And as the First Amendment kicks in and people start to realize this really is a market situation, preachers start to preach to women. And they start to present Jesus as this guy who has kids on his lap and who cares about their feelings and who they can know and they can love and who understands them. And this is a very different picture of God from the old picture of God as this distant, law-giving, ruler who makes judgments about people and sends them to heaven or hell. He's much more close to human beings and much more approachable, and this really resonates with women in the mid-19th century.
And women mattered then because they were suddenly the religious arbiters in households? Have they taken the place of men somehow?
They were more and more religious arbiters in households, but they also were numerically powerful in the churches. And once preachers started to realize that this was a market situation, that they had to sort of supply what people were demanding, when they looked out in the pews and looked at the consumers of religion, they saw women.
Now, the market that you described there, in some sense, was very real. I mean, you talk about the images of Jesus that were dominant in different periods. I wonder if you'd walk us through some of those, the way Jesus was depicted in illustrations and how that reflected what was going on with the popular understanding of Jesus.
Well, Jesus in the mid-19th century, in this period of feminization, is seen as a child, helpless, gentle, full of potential. He's also seen as a maternal figure with kids on his lap. He's also seen walking and talking closely with women. This sort of Jesus as friend really is what it becomes, how mm-hmm. it comes down to us today. And then in the late 19th century, with Teddy Roosevelt and Frederick Remington, who is this illustrator who makes illustrations for Harper's Weekly of football players and Rough Rider mm-hmm. soldiers, he starts to... Or other people start to depict Jesus in this more muscular, manly way. He's this carpenter who sweats in the carpenter shop.
Teddy Roosevelt wanted none of that feminine Jesus.
No, the feminine Jesus was to him demeaning and wasn't useful for war, for example, or even for manliness. And the culture, Roosevelt believed, was sort of sissifying and petering out because of all this feminine influence. So this tremendous upsurge in books about Jesus, the masculine Jesus, the manly Jesus, this Jesus the soldier. This all goes on in the late 19th and early 20th century, and it's not something that's done just by fundamentalists who are often associated with this move. It's also done by liberal Protestants. So it's really all across the board. There's this interest in Jesus as a much more macho figure and moving quite decisively away from this more feminine.
And then by the 50s, you get what was many Americans will remember from their childhood, this picture of the somewhere in between, a handsome Jesus lit from above, long hair, kind of olive complexion, but not too olive, sort of auburn hair. I mean, many churches and homes must have had this up on their wall. It looks almost like a figure presaging a handsome hippie.
That's right. And this was Warner Solomon's picture, Head of Christ. And Solomon later claimed that he made it to look macho, but it's very hard to see it as a macho image today. It looks quite androgynous.
He was an advertising man.
He was an advertising man, and he was a born-again Christian. And he made this picture to try to sum up the new Jesus piety, the Jesus as close to us, friend of us type person. And I think merged the more feminine views of the mid-19th century with the more macho views of the early 20th century and this more androgynous figure who does look a lot like something like an androgynous rock star of the 70s.
Now, a lot of people followed this Jesus as friend or as close companion right into the bosom of Christianity. But you're saying, Stephen Prothero, that many other Americans were able to find in that less doctrinaire depiction of Jesus some room for a relationship with this figure, even if they were not Christians or didn't have traditional Christian views at all. Give us an example.
Well, even on the Christian side, you know, the notion that you approach Jesus through theology goes away. You approach him as a person. And once Christians start to do this, it becomes possible for non-Christians to do it as well. If you're approaching him not as the God-man or the person who died to substitute and stand in for your sins, you're approaching him as this person who has these qualities, then why can't Jews or Buddhists or freethinkers or Hindus also approach him as a person with these qualities? And that starts to happen, particularly with Jews, who really take up a lot of Jefferson's language about Jesus in the 1860s. And the thing that surprised me about Jews on Jesus, and here I don't mean Jews for Jesus, by the way.
Jews thinking about talking about writing about
exactly.
Jesus.
Exactly. Virtually every major reform rabbi, liberal rabbi between the 1870s and the 1920s wrote a book or a pamphlet about Jesus. It was everywhere.
And what was their common theme, a common attitude?
That he was a great Jew who was tragically miscast as a Christian. That Paul, this apostate from Judaism, misinterpreted him, created the church. Jesus was not interested in starting the church. Jesus was an observant Jew. He was a believer and follower of the law of Judaism, and that he was a great prophet.
Frederick Douglass then had his own view of Jesus as well. The great abolitionist.
That's right. The abolitionist took up Jesus. Jesus was a great reformer. He was opposed to slavery. He was on the side of the downtrodden and the oppressed, including African Americans.
And then you have Jesus moving right on into a much broader circle. You have a specialty in Asian religions come to the States, and you say that even in the realms of Buddhism and Hinduism, Jesus has a kind of presence. How would you describe it?
Well, I first came to this book really by just finding all these images and writing about Jesus among Buddhists and Jews. The Dalai Lama has described Jesus as an enlightened being, a bodhisattva. Thich Nhat Hanh, who also writes best-selling books on Jesus, has described him in similar terms as a great meditator and a great Buddhist. Taoists will describe him as the eternal Tao. Hindus in the Vedanta Society in San Francisco, the Vedanta Societies here in Boston, will describe him as a descent of divinity, an avatar, and will actually celebrate Christmas and worship him on Christmas and sing Christmas carols. So this is not just an armchair sort of Jesus piety. It's quite an active piety in the case of these folks.
We're talking tonight with Stephen Prothero, author of the new book, American Jesus, How the Son of God Became a National Icon. You can join the conversation. Has the American Jesus outgrown Christianity? Is that possible? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Charles is calling from Newport, North Carolina. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First thing I'd like to say is both my wife and I are non-Christian. She's a Buddhist, and she considers Jesus a bodhisattva.
Okay.
She's a follower of Tibetan Buddhism.
Okay.
I myself am a spiritual humanist, and I consider him a teacher, one of the great teachers of the ages.
So you're fitting right into the Stephen Prothero thesis here that though neither of you identify yourselves as Christian, you both have an active relationship or attitude toward Jesus.
That's correct. That is correct.
Is there a question that comes out of that for you, Charles?
I do have a question. It is concerning the resurgence of the born-again Christians. Now, I do live in eastern North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. But it's a national trend.
Right. But I'm only looking at my area particularly because... Mm-hmm. 97% call themselves Christian, say they're Christian, but there's a huge resurgence of the divinity, of the godhood of Jesus here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this a national trend, returning to looking at Jesus as God?
That is a great question. It's great. And if I may extend on it, Charles, thanks for your call. Stephen Prothero, more than that, does this... movement kind of contradict your thesis? I mean, is Jesus not, really a divinity in overwhelming numbers or percentage of Americans who pay attention to Jesus?
Well, the vast majority of Americans do believe that Jesus is a divinity, and I don't mean to be saying that they don't. I think that as these options come up, Jesus as a great teacher for a spiritual humanist or Jesus as a bodhisattva, they're additive, and it doesn't mean that others don't say, oh, yes, he's the God of the Nicene Creed, or that born-again Christians don't continue to see him as divine. They do. I should say, though, even those who, if asked, was Jesus divine, you need to drill down a little below that and see how they actually relate to him. Do they relate to him as someone who tells them what to do, who instructs them, who chastises them for the things that they do? Or do they have Jesus kind of do their own bidding and create a Jesus for them who sort of pats them on the back and says, you're okay, I'm your buddy.
And you're saying the latter would not be, strictly speaking, the divine form of Jesus.
That's right. So you can say Jesus is divine, but then when it comes to how you lead your life, you're going to lead your life more thinking of him as your friend than someone who orders you around.
So to Charles' question, do you see the understanding of Jesus as a divine pulling ahead of this other trend toward Jesus as, spiritual guide, divine or not, which is dominant? Which is more prevalent in the U.S. and which is more a more dynamic view today?
Right. Well, it's definitely not an either or, and that's a main part of my argument, that clearly the vast majority of Americans who are Christians, 85%, most of those affirm Jesus' divinity. So the vast majority say Jesus is divine, but as these options arise for other people, it's not as if, you need to the culture needs to deny Jesus as divinity in order to affirm Jesus as bodhisattva. We have a both and going on here across the United States.
Is there any other country in the world that has that kind of widespread understanding of Jesus?
No. That's also what got me into this project is, you know, if you're in Europe and you talk to people about Jesus or you show them the Da Vinci Code book or you give them a book on the historical Jesus, they don't care about these things. You know, it's not important. Jesus is a unique preoccupation of Americans, and there's some very interesting combination here of religious freedom, religious diversity, and Christian dominance that makes that the case.
But in a funny way, then, the kind of freedom to interpret Jesus any way one likes, you're suggesting ultimately has made Jesus a more popular figure in this country than he would be in Europe, let's say, where perhaps the definitions were more strict and the appeal was less wide.
That's right. If you have the Catholic Church, say in France, issuing some official formal proclamation about who Jesus is, and they basically say take it or leave it, then the only Jesus party you're going to get is the people who take it. Whereas in the United States, where there isn't any established church, and it hasn't been, since the passage of the First Amendment, you have this incredible freedom.
Let's get a quick call. Ed's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to know what race was Jesus, and if he wasn't Caucasian, why has he been predominantly shown as being Caucasian in at least American society? And the last question is, does it change in terms of his depiction in other areas of the world?
Got it, Ed. Thanks for your call. Stephen Prothero.
All over the world, Jesus is depicted in whatever ethnicity artists are themselves. So you go to China, he looks Chinese. You go to Japan, he looks Japanese. You go to Thailand, he looks Thai. And so...
And in America today?
In America today, he's all over the board. Historically, there's been more Caucasian depictions of him because there's been more Caucasian artists who are doing it. But there's black Jesuses in the United States. There's Native American Jesuses. There's female Jesuses. There's all kinds of images here for Jesus.
And does the culture seem to be comfortable with that now? Or do we all live in our own little racial niche in picturing Jesus?
I think people have a sense that we don't know, that this is somewhat mysterious, and people are not in general offended, say a white person when they see Jesus depicted as black or a black person when they see Jesus depicted as white. I think we have, most of us in our heads, a kind of sense of the malleability of this figure, and we can live with some contradiction when it comes to how he's pictured.
We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the many faces of Jesus in American history and culture, America's distinctive relationship with Jesus. My guest is Stephen Prothero. He's chairman of the Religion Department at Boston University and author of the new book, American Jesus, How the Son of God Became a National Icon. Who's your Jesus? Son of God, best buddy, great philosopher, Lord, and Savior. Has the American Jesus outgrown Christianity? Is that possible? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the many faces of Jesus in American history and culture. My guest is Stephen Prothero. He's author of American Jesus, How the Son of God Became a National Icon. You can join the conversation. Christians, has the culture become too fast and loose with Jesus? Non-Christians, is there more Jesus in the culture than you're ready for? Or do you welcome the expansive American Jesus? Has the American Jesus outgrown Christianity? Is that even possible? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John is calling from Boston. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello. Nice to talk to you.
Good to have you.
In answer to the question, has the American Jesus outgrown the Jesus of Christianity? I don't know, but the minute it does, in my opinion, he ceases to be Jesus and he ceases to have the power that transforms.
So are you saying that to you it must be the divine Jesus or it's not Jesus in your book?
It must be the divine Jesus. Otherwise, we are in danger of worshiping ourselves. I think that, and I want to ask this question and direct it to Dr. Prothero, that... for example, Thomas Jefferson took parts of the Bible out. So, interestingly, he took those parts out that did not jibe with the cultural understanding of the time, anything that wasn't rationally proven. Aren't we in danger when we take too much liberty of making Jesus in our image of what we are culturally savvy?
This is a great question, John, and goes right to the heart of it, because in many ways, Stephen Prother, you are saying that Americans have made Jesus over in their own image. So?
That's right. It's a huge danger. We are in danger of worshiping ourselves, and I was not so surprised to find, but I certainly did find as I was researching this project that finding a power that transforms behind Jesus is rare rather than typical. And it's much more common to see Jesus following the culture rather than leading the culture. And I think from a theological perspective, from a Christian angle, that can be troubling, because the idea is that Jesus is supposed to be giving the orders and people are marching behind him. And that doesn't typically seem to be the case. I should say that it doesn't seem to be the case with fundamentalists and born-again Christians either.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they're part of the culture too. And as the culture starts to care about things like happiness, for example, of the individual, Jesus comes around and starts to care about that. Or as the culture moves around to rock and roll, you know, born-again music moves around to rock and roll.
Or the churches that say, worship here and you'll be more successful, more affluent, more happy, as you say.
That's right. And Jesus becomes a capitalist for many born-again Christians. You know, this is part of the message that you hear, at least in some evangelical circles. So this isn't something that happens just with non-Christians or just with liberals or just with conservatives. It's something that is a malady all across the board, if you consider it a malady.
So is this ultimately a diminishment of Jesus? I mean, I see you wearing kind of two hats here, Stephen Prother. On the one hand, you're sort of celebrating a figure of such elasticity and lasting staying power that he can, you know, step outside the bounds of one religion and still be a powerful figure. On the other hand, you're saying something's lost here.
I think that's right. With the elasticity, you know, the Gumby-like quality of Jesus, you do gain something, but you also lose something. You gain the ability to reach out to a huge crowd. You gain the ability for him to become a national figure. But it makes it tough for any one concept of Jesus to really gain particular power, and it also raises the question about whether this guy is really the king in the game or the pawn. And I think quite often he looks, at least in my history, more like a pawn than a king.
A pawn to the culture that so celebrates Jesus.
That's right.
John is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm 11 years old, and I'm ethnically Christian, but I believe in the Buddhist religion.
Okay.
There's two different views of Jesus. There's the view that he is, you know, you have to follow him, you have to, you know, do this for him and that for him in the Christian church,
but, right,
or else you're not liked. And there's also, you know, he's on Broadway, you know, he's, you know, this amazing
kind song. Of the celebrity that Stephen Prother is talking about. So where does that leave you? What does that leave you thinking, John?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking, I mean, do people comprehend him in the same way? There's one that's, you know, up there singing and dancing, and then there's the other one who's very stern and considered kind of, you know, follow me or you're going to not be liked and you're not going to be appreciated, you know. There's a big difference. And I'm my question really is, when did this really start happening? I mean, did it start happening before Broadway, or did it really start happening when Broadway was, you know, when they started picking up Christian musicals?
John, we've got it. Stephen Prothero, Jesus before Broadway?
Yeah. Well, the stern Jesus was out long before Jesus came to Broadway with Godspell and Jesus Christ Superstar and other images. I think he was really started to smile in the mid-19th century, and those stern European images of him on the cross really started to make their way out. So the happy Jesus that you find in, say, Godspell, not so much maybe in Jesus Christ Superstar, but the clowning Jesus, the happy Jesus, this is a pretty old image. And I think it's winning out over the sterner Jesus in contemporary American culture.
Does that indicate a fundamental theological change at the same time? Is this more than just which mask is put on?
I think it does. I think it shows a kind of confidence in human nature, a lack of belief in sin and hell. Jesus isn't going to be sending you to hell, hellfire, in the way that he might have in the late 1700s.
More like that guide, more like that buddy, more like that sage.
Well, more like the friend who is going to walk with you and talk with you and hold your hand and help you out, who isn't going to challenge you and tell you turn around, repent, that prophetic element that has classically been in Jesus through the influence of Judaism, I think is to a great extent going away.
Chris is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello.
Great.
I have 2 points I'd like to make. One of them is when you start talking about taking Jesus and changing his message, in all honesty, you have to look at the Bible and the church and how the church has presented Jesus over the millennium, and what was Jesus's original message? And, you know, there's scriptures, the Gnostic Gospels that have come to light recently. And, in fact, for some of us, the church has taken a lot of liberties with who Jesus was and what his message was.
Ooh, now there's an interesting thought, Stephen Prothero. And Chris, thanks for your call. Where have the greatest liberties been taken? I mean, Thomas Jefferson's point was, and that of others, that there's a lot that's been added on here post-Jesus that doesn't belong there. On the other hand, that is the Christian tradition.
Well, one of the delicious things about this question is we don't know who the original Jesus was. If we did, we wouldn't be having this conversation. And one reason religions survive and prosper, like Christianity and other traditions, Buddhism, we've talked about a little tonight, are because of the ambiguities that lie at the center of them. And one of the great ambiguities in Christianity is, who is this guy? Who is this figure? It's a question that arises in the Gospels, right? When, who do you say that I am? And Jesus gets a bunch of answers. You know, you're Elijah, or you're this, or you're that. And so even in the Gospels themselves, we have a debate, right? There's 4 Gospels, not one. There could have been one, and they could have nailed this issue down.
So there could have been there were 4, and now we have 200 and how many, 80 million Americans each free to make their own interpretation, and never mind the rest of the world. With all of that, Stephen Prothero, do you see a common thread in the understanding of Jesus? Are there any common thread elements here?
I think there are certain things that are out of bounds. Jesus as a woman has been tried, but never really gained much traction. Jesus pretty clearly seems to be a guy.
Okay.
You know, Jesus as the KKK, you know, racist has been tried.
But is there a fundamental message that the American Jesus seems to stand on, whatever manifestation, in whoever's hands?
I don't think so.
Not even love thy neighbor, not even the most fundamental?
Well, maybe that. I mean, sure. I mean, love your neighbor is certainly there. But I think what's shared here in terms of talking about American culture is we have a shared conversation about Jesus. This strikes me as quite important. We have a sense of the country really as splintering over race, class, gender, ethnicity, etc. But it's comforting to me that we have this common conversation where we might not agree about who this guy is, but we agree that he's important and we ought to be talking about him.
So a kind of cohesive quality, even if there are many, many, many interpretations out there.
That's right.
Stephen Prothero, thanks for the book. It's absolutely fascinating, and thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stephen Prothero, chairman of the Religion Department at Boston University and author of the new book, American Jesus, How the Son of God Became a National Icon. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, Howard Dean on the capture of Saddam Hussein and his vision for the future of American foreign policy. This is On Point. The capture of Saddam Hussein has presented a serious political dilemma to Democratic presidential frontrunner Howard Dean, who built his campaign around an anti-war stance as President Bush proclaimed that America's peace and security were enhanced by the arrest, and as Democratic rival Joe Lieberman accused Dean of being in a spider hole of denial. Dean delivered what was billed as a major foreign policy speech in Los Angeles today. It was a long-awaited policy statement that turned out to be completely overshadowed by events in Iraq. Nevertheless, Dean forged ahead. He called the arrest good news, but continued to attack the Bush administration's handling of Iraq and said the capture has not made America safer. Here is an excerpt of Dean's speech.
Let me be very clear. My position on the war in Iraq has not changed. The difficulties and the tragedies which we have faced in Iraq show that the administration launched the war in a wrong way at the wrong time, with inadequate planning, insufficient help, at the extraordinary cost so far of $166 billion. The administration prepared to work with others in a true partnership might have been able, if it found no alternative to Saddam's ouster, then to rebuild Iraq with far less cost and far less risk. As our military commanders have said and the president acknowledged yesterday, the capture of Saddam does not end our difficulties from the aftermath of the administration's war to oust him. There is the continuing challenge of securing Iraq, protecting the safety of our personnel, and helping that country get on the path to stability. There is the need to repair our alliances to regain global strength and global support for American goals. Nor, as the president seemed to acknowledge yesterday, does Saddam's capture move us towards defeating enemies who pose a much greater danger, Al-Qaeda and its terrorist allies. And nor, it seems, does Saturday's capture address the urgent need to halt the spread of the weapons of mass destruction and the risk that terrorists will acquire them. The capture of Saddam is a good thing, which I hope very much will keep our soldiers in Iraq and around the world safer. But the capture of Saddam has not made America safer. Addressing these critical and interlocking threats, terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, will be America's highest priority under a Dean administration. To meet these and other important security challenges, including Iraq, I will bring to bear all the instruments of power and that will keep our citizens safe and secure and our nation strong. Empowered by the American people, I will work to restore the legitimacy that comes from the rule of law, the credibility that comes from telling the truth, the knowledge that comes from first-rate intelligence undiluted by ideology, the strength that comes from robust alliances and vigorous diplomacy, and of course I will call on the most powerful armed forces the world has ever known, the military force of the United States of America, to ensure the security of this nation.
Democratic presidential contender Howard Dean speaking earlier today at the Pacific Council on International Policy. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins me now. Jack, he was up against quite a big news barrage about the capture of Saddam Hussein.
Yes, but he had public opinion, or at least public opinion 2 weeks ago on his side. 79% of Americans said that the war in Iraq has either not affected or worsened the war on terrorism, his central contention. And suddenly we're looking at that WMD and terrorism through fresh eyes with Dean. And we have a new cast of characters to worry about. Loose nukes in the former Soviet Union, for example. He goes on to talk about how Senator Lugar had practically had to beg the administration just to level fund this invaluable program to buy up these nukes. He's going to make it a big priority. And then looking at terrorism, he didn't get into it in this speech, but he's already begun to talk about Saudi Arabia and its role, and perhaps even Pakistan. So we're going to see a new sort of, here's the Dean version of the challenge.
Competing visions from the White House and from Dean. President Bush has had an awfully big microphone and dramatic events to float his vision on in the last 36 hours, Jeff.
Oh, he sure has, and I'm sure he's going to get a big bounce on it from the polls. But, hey, and it turns out the Dean is Ash Carter, Jeff Sachs, Ivo Dalder, our folks that have been on our show. They're his advisors, according to this.
Well, it takes all kinds, Jack, and we've got them right here. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.